thank you for being so patient. If you were here for the end of our 1:30 docket, you understand why we started a little late. I'll introduce your panel to you. To my right, Justice Ann Gardner. To my left, Justice Bob McCoy. I'm Leanne Dofino. And you are the only case set for oral submission on the 3 o'clock docket. And as you can tell, we're a chatty bunch today, so I can't guarantee how long your argument's going to last. Just be prepared. Understand everybody's ready, and everybody has requested their maximum time. So, Megan, call the case, please.
May it please the court, Mr. Mark Emery to argue for appellant, and Mr. Kern Lewis to argue for appellee.
May it please the court. Waffle House appreciates the opportunity to present argument to the court this afternoon. As you know, this is the second time that this case has come before this panel, but it is not a redo. The issues are different this time. The first time, the panel affirmed the court below on the basis of negligent supervision and retention. That cause of action, at least as it pertains to allegations of sexual harassment, no longer exists under Texas law. The Texas Supreme Court ruled that the Texas Commission on Human Rights Act preempts that cause of action. The Supreme Court's ruling windows down the issues that remain in this case, and the court can decide this case today on the basis of one, or if necessary, two issues. The first issue is whether Kathy Williams is entitled to continue to pursue any recovery under her statutory causes of action, or whether she has waived those causes of action by failing to file a notice of appeal from the judgment of the trial court. The second issue is whether the jury's findings on the statutory causes of action are supported by sufficient evidence. I'd like to turn straight away to the waiver issue. This case can be decided on a straightforward application of Texas Rule of Appellate Procedure 25.1C. That rule provides a party who seeks to alter the trial court's judgment or other appealable order must file a notice of appeal.
And how did she seek to alter the trial court's judgment?
She sought to alter the trial court judgment in a number of ways, Your Honor. And this can be best demonstrated by showing what the trial court granted in the judgment and what she's now seeking. The trial court granted damages based on the negligence cause of action. That is no longer supportable. It also granted an award based on pre- and post-judgment interest and costs. The judgment also denies recovery for attorney's fees, denies recovery for expert fees, and says nothing about any other relief under the Texas Commission on Human Rights Act.
So they were happy with the judgment?
We don't know whether they were happy with the judgment,
well,
but
they
didn't
appeal those issues, so they must have been happy with the judgment.
Yeah, apparently they were satisfied with the judgment because...
Okay. So I'm listening.
But at this point, what they're asking for, can read directly from the prayer, is to award Williams her alternative claims for sexual harassment by remanding the case to the trial court for determination of Williams' reasonable and necessary attorney's fees and costs and such further relief as justice may require. So Ms. Williams is now asking directly for two kinds of relief that were denied in the judgment, that is, an award for attorney's fees and award for expert fees that were available only under the Texas Commission on Human Rights Act.
So you're arguing that she's asking for greater relief
Yes.
Then she was awarded under the common law causes of action, even though it would be capped at a lesser amount.
The argument specifically, Your Honor, is that she's now asking for greater relief than what the trial court's judgment awarded. And that is what 25.1C requires that she file a notice of appeal for. So we understand this is a straightforward application of the rule in this case. The judgment issued specific relief, and then she's asked for different relief.
Different, but not greater.
Oh, it's certainly
greater.
It must be greater, Your Honor. I mean, the only theory under which she would not be asking for more favorable relief is if the money judgment was treated as some kind of fungible entity. Okay, we know that the money judgment now, I mean, there were $850,000 in damages that were awarded plus additional. Under the statute, she'd be entitled to no more than $300,000. But this is not simply a matter of just saying, well, can the judgment be reformed to be under $300,000, notwithstanding all of the other issues about the lack of evidence supporting that. She's asking for greater relief than what the judgment awarded, because we know what the judgment awarded. The judgment only awarded damages based on negligence, and the judgment denied attorney's fees and denied expert fees and did not grant her any kind of alternative recovery under the statute.
But it granted her more dollars than she would get under her alternative statutory cause of action.
Yes, but that simply can't be how 25.1C applies. The money can't simply be fungible. Each of those awards that were granted in the judgment were the result of specific legal theories. Now, Ms. Williams was aware of this because prior to the entry of judgment, she herself proposed a judgment that would have contained both awards. There would have been no reason to do that if she didn't have to ensure that all of the relief that she wanted was in the judgment. Had she received the judgment that she had asked for, one which would have granted fees of both sorts, and then acknowledged or granted some kind of recovery under the statute, then she would have had the relief that she wanted, and this would be a different case. But that's not what the judgment did.
She asked for that in the alternative. The statutory award in alternative.
Yes, she did ask for it in the alternative. And the best construction of the judgment, we think the only construction of the judgment, is that the trial court intended to deny that relief. There's no other reasonable understanding of what the court knows that when in construing a judgment, you construe a judgment like any other document. You look first at its four corners, you look at its plain language, and the court's intent is clear from that. It denied the two remedies, express remedies, that Ms. Williams asked for under the statute were denied. There's not mention of any kind of other damages recovery under the statute. But the court easily could have granted that had the court wanted to. So we know what the judgment granted. We also know what Ms. Williams is asking for now. What she wants now is directly contrary to what the judgment is. So to come back to the language of 25.1 again.
Okay, common law negligence, she wasn't entitled to attorney's fees.
That's right.
Okay, but under the Act, she is.
That's right. And the court, and so the fact that the court denied those fees shows the court's intent to deny recovery under the statute. So now when Ms. Williams is asking the court to fashion a new judgment based on the statute, the court has to find a reason to be able to grant that judgment while there's a judgment that directly denies the same relief. The only way for Ms. Williams to maintain that position and to seek that relief at this point would be to say that there was error in the trial court. Error that this court should reverse, and that a new judgment should be entered on some other kinds of grounds, or that there would be a new trial. Notably, Ms. Williams' brief nowhere asked for the court to reverse in that matter, and nowhere alleges error.
She didn't need to, though. She won.
If she intends now, as the prayer for relief says, to ask for an award of fees. Attorney's fees and expert fees and some other kind of judgment, then she certainly did need to claim error, Because the district court, the district court denied that.
She got the most favorable award. She got the greater relief. Y'all admitted that in your brief. You've agreed with that. And she got the most, the greater relief by getting her common law cause of action and the greater amount of dollars. Now, are you saying that, and the Supreme Court's taking care of it for us and saying, no, she can't get that relief, go back and consider whether she can get the alternative relief under the statute. Are you saying that she is seeking a more, that she was seeking a more favorable judgment by seeking the alternative relief?
That's exactly.
And okay, more favorable in terms of what? And I'm just not following you.
That's exactly what we're, Your Honor.
When you add up the attorney's fees and the cap damages,
compared to potential damages that Ms. Williams, or two potential judgments that Ms. Williams could have had. The one that she actually got from the trial court and the one that she wanted in her proposed judgment.
The one that she got versus the one that we're going to consider now whether she can get because it was the alternative relief that she didn't get the first time.
But it's more favorable relief because it would result in a judgment that gives her more than what she had before. The district court didn't give her alternative relief.
Yeah.
In dollars, you're telling us that she's now seeking a more relief than she got under the judgment from the trial court?
She's seeking relief under a statute for which the district court gave her no relief. The district court denied the relief under the statute.
You're telling us that she's now seeking more relief than she was ordered under the judgment that she was satisfied with?
She is, yes.
In what respect? Money?
We don't know what the end result would be in money. The damages would be capped at $300,000. If the court were to permit fees of some sort, then that could amount in other dollars. But I really want to emphasize that that is not the issue. The issue is not simply about the money.
A party who seeks to alter the trial court's judgment. Mm-hmm. She was not seeking to alter the trial court's judgment because she was satisfied with the judgment. Okay.
But now she's asking for recovery under a statute that
court apparently settled the law or I believe they used the classic case of first impression or words to that effect.
Yes.
So up until that time, she was proceeding under the most favorable judgment of the two choices.
A more favorable judgment, Your Honor, would have been one that included the alternative relief, which she knew when she asked for a proposed judgment that included that alternative relief at the time.
Okay, I can't seem to pin you down on this. You're telling us that if she had, let's call it A and B.
Mm-hmm.
A is the common law, B is the act. You're telling us that B was a more favorable judgment in money than A, and the trial court denied that. Is that what you're telling us?
I'm saying we don't know what the monetary judgment under the statute would be because there were no damages awarded under it and there were no fees awarded under it.
But the most that could be awarded in damages would be $300,000.
But no court has awarded that.
What does that mean? It's like a medical malpractice cap. The jury awards $1 million. It's capped. You know what the damages are.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But it, I mean,
300 is less than favorable than 400.
But a judgment that includes relief on several different causes of action is more favorable than a judgment that only grants it on one. And this is what Ms. Williams received.
I'm sorry, I interrupted.
Because if you have a judgment, if you have the judgment Ms. Williams had, which gives you relief only on one cause of action, that's less favorable than a judgment that includes that cause of action and, should that be overturned on appeal, an alternative award. That's a greater award. That's an award that she was never granted.
What you're really telling us is that she should have appealed judgment, the potential for judgment B in the alternative in case the Supreme Court decided that there was no common law claim and that the act was the exclusive remedy.
That's absolutely our position, Your Honor. And we and And we say that not because of the particular circumstances of this judgment. This judgment demands that outcome because of the trial court's discernible intent. We have a judgment here. It's not a mystery what the trial court intended to do with the statutory causes of action. Had it said nothing about it, this would be a different case. But that's not the judgment that we have here. We have a judgment that tells us that we can look actually at the trial court's docket sheet that says it considered these issues afterwards about how to enter the judgment. We don't know exactly why the trial court ended up denying it. But if there was any concern about this, there was one party that could do something about that. That was Ms. Williams. And 25.1C obliged her to file a notice of appeal if she wanted to contest that later on. Right now, she's contesting it.
Because the circumstances did not exist when the judgment was signed.
To the extent the court, in applying 25.1C, has to consider just cause, that is not sufficient. When the court can ask whether there's just cause to grant more favorable relief, the law is clear on this. We cite the Wagner and Brown case, that it's not a matter of whether the law is unsettled. Ms. Williams was on notice that the law was unsettled on this. She elected to take a judgment based on the fledgling theory that we plan to oppose. We did oppose, and it's now taken Waffle House nearly over 5 years to vindicate its legal position on this. We've had to incur a great deal of expense in the meanwhile. All we're asking is that litigants should have to follow the established rules of procedure and stand on their rights rather than sitting on their rights.
And so the fallout of your position is that they are entitled to?
They are entitled to nothing at this point. The court should render judgment in favor of Waffle House. I see that my time is up. Does the court have further questions?
No.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Waffle House's argument about the term greater renders the term greater in the rule meaningless, because what they're really saying is that the rule says someone who asks for any different release.
Okay, greater, tell me where you're coming from.
Rule 25.1C at the end, it says more favorable. Favorable is the term I should use. That renders that term meaningless in their argument that you have to ask for alternative claims that you're not actually being granted any relief on. Even if the court had mentioned the alternative claims, it wouldn't be granting any relief on that claim because it would be completely superseded by the election that we were required to make. So the court was not denying our statutory claim. What he was doing was granting our election of the greater common law claim.
Okay, let me see if I understand what you're saying. At that point, as the law existed at that time, you were required to elect whether to proceed or to accept a benefit under the statutory claim or a benefit under the common law claim.
Yes, ma'am.
The law required you to elect. And you followed the law and elected.
Yes, ma'am.
Well.
And so you're saying that because of that, you didn't really elect?
No, we made an election. For the more favorable relief.
You didn't really abandon.
No, we didn't abandon, but we were required because the judgment can't grant us both. So we made the election for the greater remedy under the common law claim. And therefore, when this case came up on appeal, we were not complaining one bit whatsoever about the trial court's judgment. The fact that the judgment said we were denied attorney's fees was actually meaningless because we weren't entitled to attorney's fees on the common law claim. So it wouldn't have mattered whether it said we were denied them or anything because we weren't entitled to it. So we had no complaint about that denial of attorney's fees on the common law claim.
Yeah, but this isn't this isn't where we have a settled area of law where you're choosing between your breach of warranty recovery or your strict product liability recovery. You don't know if, in fact, there is a common law claim at all because it's unsettled. And then, the Supreme Court has ruled that no, the act subsumes that. You can't go forward. You've got to utilize the act. So how do you address his argument that basically you were proceeding at your own risk by not, in the alternative, appealing the act's, let's call them negative findings by the court or however you want to call it, negative issues put in the judgment, in case the Supreme Court decided what they decided? I mean, how do you address that you needed to have appealed that in the alternative in case the Supreme Court went against you in this unsettled, let's call it, area of the law?
Well, first I would say there was no rule or case that required us to do so or that put us on notice that we needed to do so in that instance. And I would also propose to the court that the law is always in a state of change in many, many areas. There are many areas that we may think are completely settled, and we may find out tomorrow they're not as settled as we thought they were.
Even when the
legislature's not in session, the law is still in session, in a state of flux. So that doesn't, there's no pragmatic reason for doing that. We have the rule that is that this court stated in the Commonwealth versus Downs case, that there's no need. If you're not complaining about it, why bring it up? And I'll give a perfect example. It's when this court, in the underlying appeal, first considered this case, the issues on the statutory claims, the sufficiency of the evidence on the statutory claims, were briefed by both sides. And this court stated in its opinion, because we find the evidence sufficient to support the common law claims, we don't need to reach the statutory claims. And that's exactly what we were doing. Because we had been granted a judgment that we were more than happy with on the common law claim, we didn't need to reach or to complain about the denial of the statutory claims.
Often in error, seldom in doubt. Is that what you're suggesting we were doing?
Well, no, I'm just saying it's pragmatic to, when one thing takes care of the matter, why go into issues that at that point in time are not controlling? And so it's completely illogical for Waffle House to argue that the trial court felt that an $850,000 verdict was substantiated by the evidence and that he granted judgment on and he denied their motion for new trial on. And it's interesting, if you'll go back in the record in volume 12, page 116, which is cited on page 8 of my brief, the trial court talked about at the motion for new trial, listen, I listened to the evidence in this case closely, and this was a just verdict. What the jury did was fair, and it would not be fair to go back and grant a new trial. So it's illogical to believe that he felt like an $850,000 verdict was warranted, but a $300,000 verdict under the statutory claim was not warranted. So that argument is completely without merit. With regard to the sufficiency of the evidence, I would like to point out to the court that our position is that the factual evidence, the exact same factual evidence that substantiated a verdict on the common law claim, is the same factual evidence that has been found sufficient that supports the statutory claim as it did the common law claim. The Supreme Court, the reason they found there was preemption is they said that the negligence facts were inseparable from the statutory sexual harassment facts. At page 803 of their opinion, they said the common law claim is predicated on the same conduct. This court has already reviewed that conduct, found it compelling, and that it substantiated a claim that our client was harassed and that she was severely damaged. And I want to take a moment to address their argument that this conduct was not either severe or pervasive and therefore should not support a judgment. In each one of the cases they mentioned, where the Fifth Circuit primarily found that summary judgment was proper on the claim, those cases involved conduct that the Fifth Circuit was basically saying was horseplay, that it did not alter a term or condition of the person's employment. In this case, there was evidence that Ms. Williams suffered a tangible psychological injury. They heard from a psychologist who testified about she had to go on anti-anxiety medication. She began grinding her teeth. Her hair began to fall out. She was shaking and trembling, and she was physically unable to go to work on the day that her husband finally said, you just can't do this. And this was after a period of 8 months of harassment. This is not a single incident like they refer to in some of the cases in their brief. This was 8 months of no one doing anything after repeated complaints. So while this was not a single isolated incident, there was repeated ignoring the conduct by four different managers in this case: Manager Ajani, Manager Love, Manager Marshall, and Manager Conley. And Waffle House wants to say, well, it doesn't matter that we ignored the conduct after the complaints. We had some real nice policies that we put in a handbook. And because we enact policies, that's all we have to do. We can wash our hands after that. And that is not what the law says. The law requires them to take prompt remedial action. And that is something that is their burden. And they've submitted to the jury. Question number 12 asked if Waffle House had made a good faith effort to prevent sexual harassment in the workplace, and the jury said no. So based upon that, we believe the evidence is more than sufficient to substantiate this verdict. We ask the court to remand the case to the trial court for the consideration of the attorney's fees that go along with the statutory claim. Thank you.
Any questions? Be careful when you sit down, you may do that again.
First, on the waiver issue, as opposing counsel stated, to some degree the law is always in flux, I don't think this is a case to carve out what I think would be a significant exception to the application of 25.1C. Yes, it's not that often that the Supreme Court ends up reversing the sole cause of action, and it's necessary to come back and ask about alternative theories. But I would ask the court to consider very carefully what the ramifications of not finding waiver in this case are. Potentially, it's not an uncommon scenario for a plaintiff to have jury findings on several different issues. If the court renders judgment on one and is either silent or denies recovery on several of those other grounds, the doors would be open for a continual revisit to the courts to ask the courts of appeals to refashion new judgments. Here we have the very obstinate fact that the trial court made a decision to deny two of the specific forms of relief under the statute. It shows what the trial court's intent was here. And so this is not simply an instance where you can come back and replenish your judgment by drawing on new theories. It's necessary to overcome the trial court's intent as expressed in the judgment in this case.
Aren't you, in effect, saying that the Supreme Court was wrong then in sending it back to us to consider the statutory claim?
Not at all, because again, drawing on the language from this court's opinion the first time, the court bracketed as the second issue, what it called statutory sexual harassment issues, that were both the waiver issue and the substantive claim. The Texas Supreme Court's opinion footnoted and referred exactly to that language in the court's opinion. So the court intended this court to visit both the waiver issue and, if necessary, the statutory sexual harassment issues.
What you've been saying is to deny relief under the Act.
Your Honor, We cannot say one way or the other.
From the record, but pleadings, evidence, charge of the court, judgment.
I would say independently, there's ample basis for the trial court to have drawn the conclusion. I mean, it's at the trial court's discretion whether to deny the fees. As well, there's insufficient evidence. Whether or not that was the basis for the trial court's position, the record doesn't say one way or the other.
But what about damages under the Act?
There were none awarded. So, to the extent there was any doubt about that, that it was incumbent on Ms. Williams to raise that issue. If I could, I'd just like to say one thing in response to the sexual harassment issues, because I think there's been a serious misstep made by Ms. Williams in this case in saying that the court's prior opinion can simply be a stand-in for the analysis done that needs to be done this time. This would completely displace the importance of the Texas Supreme Court's opinion in this case. We've cited these passages. The court expressly contrasted what was necessary for the court to find first time when it was considering the negligence claims and what's necessary to consider this time. Specifically, for the first time, it was only necessary to find one predicate assault, and then we could move to an assessment of Waffle House's negligence. This time, it's necessary to find actionable, hostile work environment sexual harassment. And that involves a severe and pervasive permeating environment that changed a term, condition, or privilege of Ms. Williams' employment. Mr. Davis's conduct in this case did not arise to that level. And we can cite to the plentiful precedents that we have in the briefs that distinguish between what's necessary to establish that kind of hostile work environment from intermittent offensive acts or boorish acts, things of that sort. Mr. Davis's conduct did not arise to that level, and so as a threshold issue, there was not actionable sexual harassment in this case. As well, as a matter of law, Waffle House demonstrated its affirmative defenses at trial, and so jury finding number four, we think, should not have been submitted to the jury. There was prompt remedial action that was taken in this case. Within the first week or two after the incidents, Waffle House moved Mr. Davis to another shift, and after that time, the actions almost entirely ceased. That kind of action is sufficient. I apologize. If there are no more questions?
Well, I have a question. The Supreme Court said at the very end in the conclusion, as the complaint of acts constitute actionable harassment under the TCHRA, they cannot moonlight as the basis for negligence. So you're saying that's not binding on us in any way?
No, Your Honor, the opinion also makes it clear that the substantive sexual harassment issues were not briefed to the Supreme Court, that those issues were not before the court, and the Supreme Court absolutely did not decide whether there was actionable sexual harassment in that case, and that's why it remanded the issue to this court.
Okay. That's not exactly what that sentence says, but okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
I appreciate your argument. Case is submitted. You are released to go about your business, and this court will be adjourned.
All rise. The Honorable Court is adjourned.